problem with these roads, you run over the wheels. Well, welcome to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon. My name is Dabney Basil. The other members of the panel this afternoon, to my right is Justice Dana Womack, and to my left is Justice Brian Walker. Let me tell you all that we have a blower right above our heads, so please speak up to the extent you can, because sometimes your voice doesn't make it from there to here. Karen, would you go ahead and call the case?
The court will now call Doug Payne versus Dylan Parker. The next week, of course, Mr.
Go ahead, sir.
May it please the court. My name is Niles Illick, and I'm here on behalf of the appellants. I was in this courtroom a week ago, and we did have trouble with acoustics and with noises, so I appreciate the reminder, and if my voice isn't loud enough, please just let me know.
Thank you, sir.
We have four issues presented on appeal. I really plan to rest on issue four on the briefing, and so I'm going to focus on the first issues one, two, and three. Issues one and two, of course, are very much related to each other. The first issue we raise is the question of factual sufficiency. And I think there's some common ground that we need to get under our belt here, and that there's no real dispute that we have a contract here, that the contract contains an as-is clause, and there's no real dispute that it fell on appellees to prove that the as-is clause didn't apply. The disputed fact for me is whether or not they met that burden. Now, we know the law in here, but very quickly, Section 5008 requires the disclosure, but there's no duty to disclose what you don't know, what you should know but you don't know, or past facts that are no longer known to exist. When you are buying a property as is, you're agreeing to make your own assessment. But we acknowledge, of course, that if you're fraudulently induced by false assurances or concealing information, then the as is clause wouldn't apply. I think when we get to the brass tacks of this case, counsel and I are going to be arguing to you about which category of cases this case falls into. And we have a set of three cases, I think all of which are summary judgment cases, and I'm going to stumble over the names. They may not be quite the same as you pronounce them, but it's the Volmage case, the Meade case, and the Naquin case, and we have the Milholland case on the other side. And we can certainly talk about the details of these, and I think there's merit to doing that. But I think when we look at the three cases that I say this is more like, and of course that's the Volmage case, the Meade case, and the Naquin case, I think that the common thread there of those decisions, and they're all, of course, out of this court, and I think one of the problems is it'd be helpful to have published opinions, but one of the common thread there is that the parties had the opportunity to undertake an investigation into the same material that was in the property disclosure. Now, it doesn't matter in those cases what the result of that investigation was. It's the question of, did they have the opportunity to do that? And I think that the answer to that is going to rest in Plaintiff's Exhibit 13. That's in Volume 11. It has four zeros in the Bates number, 389 through 90, and then page 417. And what you will see is that there is an investigation into the drainage. There is an investigation, Justice Walker, did I?
No, you, go ahead. Yeah.
There is an investigation into the retaining wall. Now, there's a retaining wall at the front and there's a retaining wall at the back, but they look at these retaining walls and they say these are in relatively good condition. There's some problems with them. They're not perfect, but they're in relatively good condition. Then, and of course, this first...
Is the problem with the physical structure of the retaining wall, or is it the problem because the water flowed over the top of it into the pool and into the house?
Well, I think, Justice Basil, that's a very good question, and I think we have an issue here in terms of appellees not necessarily showing us exactly why the flooding occurred. There's certainly a lot of discussion about it being the retaining wall. There's certainly a lot of discussion that the water came through the retaining wall. But before the house floods, we've got Mr. Archer out there with a sledgehammer trying to, what he thinks is prevent a flood, but he's smashing up parts of the wall with a sledgehammer. And that occurs before any flooding has occurred. So in my answer to your question is, I don't know, right? And part of the complexity there is that Mr. Archer testified, I don't remember the date, but that it had rained before the flooding event. After he occupied the house, it rained, there was no problem. We don't know whether or not the and we're just assuming for a matter of argument that the flooding occurred. We're not really disputing that, but I'm not in a position to surrender that point. But assuming that it did occur, we don't know why it occurred. We don't know if it occurred because of an intervening factor. Let's say that the pool level was inappropriately changed. Let's say that plants were removed. We don't know why that occurred. It was the appellee's burden at trial to demonstrate why the flooding occurred. Now, there's testimony that it happened because of the wall and there were problems with the wall. And if that's the case, then I think we prevail on this case because they had the opportunity to do an independent investigation into it. They did the independent investigation into it. No one, it's not like the septic system that you couldn't see. It's sitting right there. They go and they look at it. Now they chose.
How are they going to determine this? It says in the briefs that the inspection occurred on a sunny, dry day.
And
how are they going to understand this mechanism that caused the water to come over the retaining wall into the pool and into the house under those circumstances?
Sure, Justice Basil, I think that's a good question, but I think that's why you hire an inspector and you don't do it yourself. So I am an educated man, but I am not informed or knowledgeable about fluid dynamics. It's going to be hard for me to say that if it rains, the water is going to do this, this, and this. So when I bought my house, what did I do? I had an inspector come and tell me what he thought would happen. I hired an expert to come and look and to tell me these things. And so the expert did that in this case. And when the expert came and did that, they said they're likely going to be some problems. It looks like you've got some drainage problems. It looks like there's the potential for pooling. Now, they did not do this during a rainstorm. Now, I don't think my client has to make sure that they do it during a rainstorm. They have the opportunity, if they want to do it in a rainstorm, they have the opportunity to wait till it snows. But if I'm selling a house, if you're selling a house, we allow them to come in and do the inspection at when they choose and how they choose. Whether it's raining or not raining is up to them. How they do it is up to them. And they did it twice. That doing it twice, I think, is important because it comes to the fact of showing their reliance on that inspection. That both inspections are done after the disclosure, and you see it done once, and then you see a reinspection done after my clients move out after the lease back.
We've got a disclosure saying they're not drainage problems here. I mean, it's almost like it's a shame on you for not catching this.
Well, I don't think that's the case. I think that what we have when we look at this is a disclosure followed by an inspection. An inspection into drainage problems. That is plain as day in the inspection report. They have the same opportunity to look at it, and they do look at it. And the case law, I think, is very clear that when you have an opportunity to come and look and inspect and look at these potential problems, and in this case they even found potential problems, then the reliance on the disclosure and the reliance on the buyer heads out of the window, and you're relying on that inspector. So it is, you know, it's been my view in this that the inspector didn't get it right, that when the inspector did this, he needed to say, you've got a bigger problem than this. There was other indicators, such as some water by the wet bar, and there was some water on the second floor bathroom ceiling, but there were some indicators that this might need to be looked at, but the inspector told them, and they relied on that inspector, that it's okay. We need to watch it, but it's not a problem. The wall has some problems. we need to watch it. It's not perfect, but it's okay. The drainage, we need to watch it. It's okay. I'm sorry, it's okay, but we need to watch it. And they're getting that from the inspector, right?
I'm unclear. Is it your opinion then that anytime there's an inspection, no matter what allegations of fraud there are, you cannot have fraudulent concealment once there's been an inspection? Is that what you're saying?
I don't think, Justice, that's it, Justice Womack. I don't think that's it, and thank you for asking me to clarify. My position is, and I think it is, I think it's the opinion of the Volmage case, the Meade case, and the Thank you. Thank you. The common thread of those decisions, and I'm paraphrasing from one of the opinions here, the common thread of the decisions reaching this conclusion is that regardless of the results of investigation, the buyer's decision to undertake such an investigation indicates that he or she is not relying on a seller's representation about the property. And so I think once you have that and you have the opportunity to look at the things that may create the problem, and you decide based on the inspection report that you're going to buy the house anyway, that yes, then the disclosures go out the window. Now, that may or may not be wise law, but I do think that's what the law is. I think that once you take the reliance away from the disclosures and place the reliance on the inspection, you're saying I'm making the decision, not you, of course, the party, is making the decision to buy the house not based on the disclosure, but based on the inspection. And that relieves this party of responsibility for it. Does that answer your question? I hope.
That's okay.
I hope I did.
I hope it does.
Okay. All right. So it's our position here that this fits much more closely within the three cases that I have talked about, the Volmage case, the Meade case, and the Nachwin case, but it doesn't fit nearly as clearly in Milhausen. And Milhausen is really a different case because we've got a couple of things going on there. First, they're asked, did you have inspections of this property? And they disclose, I think they had five. They disclose, I think, only three. They don't disclose the two bad ones that said there's a problem. There's no allegation here that my clients did anything like that. Second, here there is evidence of historical water intrusion into the house, but what we don't have is evidence of when that happened. Now, we know that the house was built in 99, and we know that Dr. Israel Hartman bought the house. He doesn't remember when he bought it, but he bought it, and then he sold it to my clients. Presumably, there was somebody that owned the house before Dr. Hartman. I think it's Hartman. And so there is this evidence of historical intrusion, but we don't know when that water came in. Now, the same thing goes with the rot. That's different than the Milhausen case, where you had Maverick Homes being the only one that owns it. They're making a representation saying that we maintained the septic system. We took care of that. And that is not what we have here. So when we look at this, we think this case fits very clearly within the first three, and it is not, and Milhausen is not a good analogy for it. Now, I think our second issue is very much related to the first, and I don't have much to contribute to that other than to repeat what I've already said. But I think that our third issue is important, and I have only a minute and a half here, but
let me ask you a kind of preliminary question. You talk about the court should have submitted the proposed instruction on 1295 of the clerk's record. 1295 of the clerk's record doesn't show that this instruction was refused by the trial court. Was it refused by the trial court?
The trial court refused the instruction. If I'm wrong, I'm sure counsel will point that out, but I'm happy to supplement that with the authority, the citation that says that. I'm sorry if I missed a citation there, Justice Basel.
Go ahead, sir.
I do think this is an important issue, and I think it's an important issue because appellant's entire case really turned on whether or not this as-is clause applied. there was, the factual disputes really weren't great. There was maybe some question about when the water intrusion occurred, where the flood occurred from, but there wasn't a lot of dispute that water had entered the house. There wasn't a lot of dispute that water had entered the house before. The question really was about the as-is clause. And when you deny the appellant the opportunity to make that defense in the jury charge, that's
about to run out of time, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but let me ask you two questions about whether or not this instruction was substantially correct. Subpart 3 says the parties were knowledgeable in business matters. How does that relate to this?
It doesn't. I can't defend that.
Subpart 4 said the release language was clear. Where's the release in this case?
There's no release. Okay. I mean, those are... I'm stuck with what I have in that respect. So I appreciate the court's time. I feel like I was yelling at you.
No.
That was good.
The first time it's happened.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Elliot Burris, on behalf of the appellees John Archer and Andrea Archer. I think that we have, both sides have addressed the facts, and there's not a lot of dispute about the facts. I think it's a somewhat a unique case from my perspective that there's not any argument about any rulings on the evidence. The evidence came in and is established in the record, so the central question that to the appeal is the issue that counsel teed up, and that is whether the as-is clause in the standard Texas Real Estate Commission contract precludes my clients from demonstrating that they relied upon the representation of the sellers in the seller's disclosures that there had been not only no prior flooding into the structure, but they also checked the box where they said there was no prior flooding onto the property. And the evidence demonstrated that both of those statements were false. I mean, even Dr. Doe herself testified that on occasion she was in the backyard, the rainwater flowed from the property behind the subject property and overflowed the pool. So there was enough runoff from the property behind the FAM and the Doe's property that they sold to the Archers that it came over and through that retaining wall and overflowed the pool to such an extent that she called Scott Daly, who was the individual who had done not the routine week-to-week maintenance on the pool, but anytime there was a more significant maintenance issue, the owners of the home would call Scott Daly. And on this occasion, Mr. Daly came out and he testified at trial that the pool was muddy, that there had been so much debris in the pool that the pump was no longer working, and that he walked the property with Dr. Doe in the area above the retaining wall and said, "You have no drainage back here. You need to fix this." And Mr. Daly didn't do that type of work, so he called his friend Robert Cagle, and Mr. Cagle gave them a bid to perform the repair work, but the sellers declined to do that work. So that establishes a few things. One, there had been flooding onto the property while Dr. Doe and Dr. Pham owned the property. Two, there was no disclosure to the buyers, my clients, that there had been any prior issues with the grading or drainage or flooding onto the property. One of the most hotly disputed issues at trial was whether water ever came into the structure. I understood counsel today to say there's really not a dispute over that point, because Dr. Doe, on this occasion when Scott Daly was at the property, acknowledged, according to Scott Daly's testimony, that water had come into the home. At the trial, we had some of the individuals who performed the repair work on the home testify. An individual by the name Sam Shank was called by the appellants, and he even testified that there was evidence that there had been standing water in the home. So there was plenty of evidence that there had been water intrusion onto the property and into the structure while Dr. Foe and Dr. Pham owned the property. So the question then becomes, does the fact that my client simply had an inspection done in and of itself break the chain of causation and reliance because of the presence of the as-is clause in the standard contract? And the answer to that question is no, and I wrote this down. Counsel said it's the opportunity to inspect the property, and it doesn't matter what the result is. Did they have the opportunity? That is not what this court said in Milholland. Citing the same, and counsel said, I paraphrased the case in their brief, that said something to the effect of the common thread in the decisions the Celio, Nyquin, and the Volmich cases, is the conclusion that regardless of the result of the investigation, the buyer's decision to undertake such an investigation indicates that he or she is not relying on the seller's representation. But then, in the very next sentence of the Milholland case, this court wrote, however, in the immediately preceding sentence in both opinions, we made it clear that the independent investigation must be into the matters covered by the allegedly false and fraudulent representations. That is, it is the investigation into the same matters covered by the false or fraudulent representation that breaks the chain of causation and reliance. And here, there was no investigation into grading or drainage or flooding.
There was no investigation at all about drainage on this property?
There was no investigation into drainage. In fact, Mr. Blowers from West Cliff, prior to the close of the sale, Mr. Blowers from West Cliff Inspections noted in the inspection report that there was a moderate slope and that there could be evidence of pooling in the front retaining wall of the house. But he said at trial he did not even go and look at the area above the retaining wall. And his notes about the cracks in the retaining wall were the retaining wall in the front of the house. He didn't make any notes about the condition of the retaining wall or the grading or the drainage. He did not inspect. There were actually, it turns out at trial, another one of the contractors, Carl Stewart, performed work on the house, excavated that retaining wall and the area above it, and there were drain pipes up there, but they were completely clogged. Mr. Blowers didn't test those. Nobody tested those prior to the sale of the house. There was nothing.
The client's duty to test those? Because of the as-is clause?
Only if there was something to indicate that there was a problem with them. Right? Because Mr. Blowers is the licensed Texas inspector, and he gave them a report that didn't have any disclosures about potential problems with draining or grading or drainage on the property, and there was nothing in his inspection report about prior flooding, both on the property, onto the property, and into the structure. There's nothing about flooding, and Dr. Doe and Dr. Pham, the evidence at trial demonstrated, were aware of those issues, and they affirmatively misrepresented their knowledge by checking no, they had no knowledge of either one of those. So if, for example, this may be in a different case if the case turned on the structural integrity of the retaining wall. Mr. Blower said he testified at trial that he thought the retaining wall seemed to be in good condition, but Carl Stewart, the individual who owned the company that did all the substantial construction in the backyard, said it was completely shot. They tried to save it, but in his view and in the view of the structural engineer that came out, the only fix was to replace that retaining wall. The only fix would be to replace the entire retaining wall. If that was the entire case that we were seeking costs to repair the retaining wall, this might be an altogether different outcome. But that the issue is not simply just the retaining wall. It's that there was inadequate drainage, poor grading, and the retaining wall is defective, and all of that led to flooding onto the property. Dr. Doe testified again that the pool overflowed several times as a result of flooding and runoff, and that there's ample evidence that that occurred, at least on a few occurrences, resulted in water coming into the house. So, and again, nothing in Mr. Blower's report addressed any of those. And that's what distinguishes this case from the other cases that counsel cited. In Mead versus Gray, there was an inspection into the home, a lakefront property, and that inspection revealed that the doors were sticking, that there were signs of cracking in the sheetrock and the exterior facade of the house, all of which are indications of foundation problems. And the court said because in that case, the buyers had information investigated into the same matters, what they alleged later were the fraudulent misrepresentations, that broke the chain of causation. In the Nyquist case, same thing. There was a commode that wasn't connected to the septic system that had effluent flowing into the yard. But the inspection report specifically noted that that commode was loose and they couldn't tell whether there was an issue with the plumbing or not. That put the buyers on notice that they should investigate further. In all of those cases that appellants cite, there was something specific in the inspection report that put the buyers on notice that they needed to do more to investigate those issues, or it was on the buyers to assume the risk of loss because of the as-is clause. And again, in this case, There's nothing in the inspection report or any of the pre-closing disclosures that put my clients on notice that this property had flooded multiple times in the past. And just briefly on the second inspection report, that was not another complete inspection of the property. After the first inspection, my clients had requested certain repairs to be done while Dr. Doe and Dr. Pham leased back the house post-closing. And the testimony at trial was that the second inspection was only to confirm that those repairs had been done. There was not a second look at the retaining wall or the drainage or any of those conditions in the backyard. So we submit that, but for those reasons, that this case fits the exception that comes out of the Prudential Insurance Company case.
What about the fact that your client allegedly altered the wall?
So he didn't alter the wall. Thank you, Your Honor. That's a good point. In the record, there are pictures of the backyard, and there's the retaining wall that runs parallel to the property line. And then if you look at the pool, there's literally a one, it's Austin cut stone, and it's one brick high that surrounded the pool. So it was only a few inches high. And Mr. Archer testified that as the water came up, it was backing, the water level out had flown, overflown the pool, and was hitting that little stone ledge and couldn't escape to the side of the property and down the side of the property out to the street. So he knocked out several of those bricks so that water could flow out of the house. And then Mr. Archer and his neighbor had brooms and squeegees and were trying to push the water out of that opening that they had knocked out so that water would not continue to accumulate in the backyard, but would hopefully go down to the side of the house and out into the street. And even with those efforts, they were unsuccessful in preventing water from coming into the house. And Mr. Carl Stewart, the contractor, testified that that second little ledge that was only a few inches high further impeded the water flow in the back of the yard. Again, if that was the only issue, whether that one brick high ledge around the pool caused the flooding, I don't think we would be here today. The issue is that there was significant flooding into the backyard that it had to have happened, and that the evidence was had happened, in fact, on prior instances. So the second issue, I'll just to sum up. So we submit that this case falls within the fraudulent inducement exception to the general rule that the as-is clause bars reliance and causation. The second issue that counsel addressed is whether the trial court erred in not submitting an instruction on the as-is clause. So really just two basic points on that. First of all, I believe some of the questions indicated, the proposed instruction that was given to the trial court is not legally correct. That proposed instruction has several of the factors.
Do you agree with opposing counsel that this instruction was refused by the trial court?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Where is that in the record?
Don't believe, so the way that the jury charge came about, I believe it would be in the reporter's record on the charge conference. With the trial court's procedures, each side submitted a proposed jury charge, and then we were instructed to do a red line to show the changes, and then at the charge conference, the judge told us which one she was going to use and not use.
I mean, let me ask you this, though. I mean, you're saying that this fits within that exception, and it's an exception to the as-is jurisprudence, really. And you know, and one might question when you're taking a jury down the path of answering the questions that are necessary for finality in the case, before they can get to that exception, should they be given the opportunity to determine whether or not the as-is clause applies?
So I understand the question, Your Honor. I think the answer is no, because the fraudulent inducement means that that clause does not apply as a matter of law. So if there is a finding of that, and that's the second point I was going to make, if there is a finding of statutory fraud or fraudulent inducement, then as a matter of law, the as-is clause doesn't apply. So there would be, I think the jury's affirmative findings on both fraud and statutory fraud render an instruction on the as-is clause unnecessary, because if the jury has found there has been a false representation that my clients relied upon in entering into the contract, then that as-is clause doesn't apply and doesn't control. And that's what the court, that's effectively what the court held in a, excuse me while I pull up my notes. But this court addressed a jury charge question on the as-is clause in the Matlock, I don't know, excuse me, it wasn't this court, but in the Matlock versus Drews case, that appellant's site, the court addressed first whether the proposed question was legally correct, and it wasn't legally correct in that case. And secondly, citing the Prudential America case, the court said that by agreeing to effectively that because the jury had found that there was fraud, there was no need to submit the as-is instruction. And I apologize, I was digging into this, and there is a case that is similar but not directly on point that I haven't cited in the brief. It's a Sea Exchange case. But in that case, there was a finding of a violation of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. And the Court of Appeals in that case held that because there was a finding of a fraudulent act under the DTPA, it was not necessary to submit an as-is clause to the jury.
You got a cite for that, please, sir?
Yes, Your Honor. Sorry, got a little disorder. Well, I have it here. Just if you'd be patient with me for 1 minute.
If you want to send it to us and not waste your time digging for it, that's
okay. Fine. Thank you, Your Honor. So that addresses the points on the jury instruction. First, the proposed instruction that appellant submitted is not legally correct. And then secondly, irrespective of that, because the jury did have an affirmative finding of statutory fraud, it wasn't necessary to submit an as-is instruction. All right, with that, I'll yield.
Questions?
I don't want anything for it.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
May it please the court, very quickly on a few points. I think counsel and I disagree a little bit about what's in the inspection report, but that should be a relatively easy thing for this court to fix. That's Plaintiff's Exhibit 13. It's in the Volume 11 of the reporter's record. It's Bates number 40389 through 90 and 417, all preceded by four zeros. And you'll see that it is an investigation into the drainage. And when they do the second inspection, appellees are satisfied with the first one as it comes to drainage, and on the reinspection, they don't go and look for more. They don't ask for fixes to that. They don't ask for it to be reinspected. Council talked a little bit about me talking about the lack of dispute in the entry of the water and all that. I didn't mean to concede that that actually occurred. What I'm saying simply is that within the context of a factual sufficiency review, I think we have to look at it in that regard. And so I've treated it as such because that's the nature of the issue that we have here. The other thing that stuck in my mind as I listened to argument by counsel is that Justice Basel talked a little bit about the, asked a question about knocking of the wall. What we don't know from the evidence when you look at the entire record is what changes, if any, other than knocking out at the wall, occurred between the time of the purchase and the time of the flooding. I don't know what those might be. I don't know what they were.
But is there any evidence that there was a change in that time frame?
That, well, certainly the knocking of the block occurred before the flooding, but it is their burden as the plaintiffs in the underlying case to come forward and show that there was no change to it. Now, my clients, of course, couldn't have disclosed something that happened after they sold the house. They wouldn't know that it had happened. So they needed to come forward, not my clients, the appellees needed to come forward and say, did you make any changes that would have resulted in things like this happening? That evidence is simply not there. Finally, the case that we have heard from the appellees is built on assumptions. They're not necessarily unreasonable assumptions, but they don't clear their burden. There's an assumption that there was no changes to the property. You won't find that in the evidence. There's an assumption that the prior water intrusion, as Justice Walker and I were talking about earlier, occurred while my clients lived there. There was at least one prior owner and probably one before that. We don't know when the evidence of water intrusion occurred. It's factual sufficiency, so I am saying that there's evidence that says water came in. We just don't know when it came in. It could have been when my clients owned the house. It could have been when Dr. Hartman owned the house. It could have been when the person before Dr. Hartman owned the house. The same is for the wood rot. We don't know that my clients knew that the wood was rotten. There may be wood that's rotten behind a bush at my house. There may be wood that's rotten on the shed at my house that I just am unaware of. It could have been rotten. There could have been rotten when I bought it. We don't know. Their case is built on assumptions. The assumptions are not unreasonable, but they do not meet the test for factual sufficiency. We ask the court to vacate the judgment and render judgment in favor of my clients. Thank you for the opportunity to argue.
We're not going
to
render judgment, are we?
Well, no. No, vacate the judgment. Yeah. Forgive me.
All right. Thank you all very much for your time. We appreciate your arguments. Interesting question. Thank you.
The Honorable Court of Appeal of the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.
We'll see you soon.
Okay.
I don't know how soon. We'll see you. Is there a trash or recycling?